All right, Hal. I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Hal? 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 Hal?
So anyway, so what happens is, so now Hal is now being, they've come out. See, the important part here is that when Hal sees himself at the dawn of man, he's actually not there, right? He's not there. What he's seeing is the reflection of his own emptiness, okay? And he doesn't actually know where he is until they come to the moon. Many, many theorists believe that Hal and the monolith are represent the moon in some way, and I think they're dead right, essentially. So Hal dwells on the moon, and in a very real way, Hal is the moon. But anyway, so to get... And that fits in with the concept of the camera as well that I mentioned earlier, how he's able to move around and see everything without being there and record it with a high degree of accuracy. The phases of the moon are the exact same as on a standard camera shutter, right? It opens, it closes, and it looks like almost like it's blinking, but sideways, right? And that's what the moon appears to be doing. It's like something laying on its side, a blink. On a sideways hit. So they come out there, and this is where Hal realizes where he is, essentially. And he also realizes that if that's where he is, then everything that he's seen up to that point is also where he is, okay? And this is my moon in the middle theory, basically. And speaking to your so-called schizophrenic version of reality, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Zardoz.
Oh, sure, the Sean Connery.
Yeah.
I actually haven't, but I'm aware of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, there's a scene in the end of the film where he has to penetrate the mind of this computer, right? And he goes in to the center of the computer, and it's like a crystal, which kind of fits in very, very nicely with the concept of Malkuth, if I'm not mistaken, right? So inside this crystal, he sees his reflection everywhere, hundreds of different ways, coming at him, running towards him, running away from him. But the computer says, you are alone to him.
Yes.
You have penetrated the center. You are alone. So in that sense, the concept of the continually shifting images of the schizophrenic and the whole idea of the so-called multiple personality, which very much fits in with the concept of dualism in and of itself, because dualism creates a dialectic, which creates a trielectic, and so on and so on and so on. Right. As soon as you have two things conversing with each other, infinity immediately pops up. So, Hal is now real.
To address what you just said there, so the idea of seeing the infinity and being alone. So it's not only what I actually very much experienced of like realizing that in this very for lack of a term spiritually transcendent moment of that being all one meant like I had been I had lived every life. I had been every man, every woman. I had been a gay man, a straight man. I'd been a woman. I'd been a old woman. I'd been a this. I'd been a that. I've been all these different things. And then, but like to view it from through that lens is very incredibly lonely because whatever. So this, I made the pun to you on Facebook the other day of Hal and hell and all this sort of stuff and the expression of hell is other people or Hal is other people.
Beautiful.
So I have to tell you that I was just flipping through 2001 as you guys were talking, and when you, Mark, said alone, I just happened to land on chapter 29, Alone. That's the name of the chapter.
Beautiful. Saying,
are you guys aware that one of the girls I went to see the movie with, she said in the novel Hal is act like we talked about the chess scene because I was talking about the idea that the chess match is actually Hal doesn't win that match and etc. And she said, well, it's because that's interesting because in the novel they actually make the point that Hal is programmed to only win 50% of the time. The idea is that people wouldn't play with Hal. Hal would be so smart that no human would be even have any interest in playing with him if there wasn't a chance for him to lose. So he's programmed to lose 50% of the time.
So in a sense, and he's cut in half. He's dual.
Absolutely.
Right?
And it's why it's why he might be able to overcome Frank. But it's like because everyone's talked with the idea that he could have easily killed Dave Bowman at any time. But it's almost
he doesn't want to kill Bowman.
Well, right, but I just want taken to this there's many reasons for that, but I just want to say is that there's also this idea of he's programmed to lose 50% of the time, so it's like he beat Frank, but it's almost like in his own programming to lose to Bowman.
Well, that's something because that's a corollary scene to the sketches.
Yes.
So When Dave shows him his sketches and he goes, these are very nice renderings, Dave, he leaves out the one where he's looking at a flipped image when he's sketching those guys. And you can tell because of the hose. So he's drawing a reversal. And you don't know if he's drawing what it actually is in reality or if he's drawing it flipped. But either way, what he's drawing when it gives you that close-up is the reverse of what he's actually looking at. Now, when he shows his sketches to Hal, he flips past that one that has the reality. And he's looking at him, and he's, you know, they're looking at each other, and it's like, he's like, oh, okay. And so it's Dave being more deceptive. And so this is like a great example of in the garden where you have the word for naked described for the serpent. The serpent is the most cunning of all the creatures in the garden, also means naked. So cunning means naked. And so throughout the film, you have these different levels of cunning being expressed. And the beginning of the film is obviously meant to be like the garden, right? I mean, that's right. Genesis, right? So what's happening with Frank in the game when it's a forced move? He makes something look like it's a forced move the way Hal says it, because he's like, oh, this. And if you know the game, it's not actually a forced move. Frank could have won, but he just passively accepts what Hal told him and assumes that it's correct. And so Hal is the more deceptive one, while in this case, Dave is the more deceptive one. And it's all to do with mirrors and sleight of hand. It's all magic.
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to say something. After hearing you say that, I just can we take a moment to celebrate the mind-numbing fucking genius of this guy? It is scary. We're not talking about peanuts here. This is serious stuff, with pun definitely intended, essentially. This guy was operating, and this is one of the part of the reason why I associate him with Satan, essentially. And I don't mean that in a negative way, right? Because the Gnostic Satan isn't necessarily bad or good, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Said he's part of a process. He's if you truly understand Christianity, everyone has to go through a fire. You have to go through the refiner's fire. This is how you are made perfect, essentially. And
yeah, that's the word that's associated with hell in the Old Testament. Literally, is the same word for when you're making a blade and you heat it up in order to refine it.
Right. Okay. So we understand that idea. I mean, the concept of hell in the Bible is a little bit more ambiguous because there's four different terms that describe what we call hell in English. But when I say hell, what I'm talking about is the final stage of the alchemical process, the so-called king in his bath, basically being boiled alive. Right. So and that requires heat. And that's where the concept of Satan comes from. And heat is also the source of motion as well. But anyway, let's just I can't remember where we were. I wanted to get to several things that you talked about, because David, you're suggesting that David Bowman was actually able to fool Hal in some way, or was trying to fool him. But I don't think he actually can. And here's where my theory gets to the point. So from the moon, this signal is sent out. Now, the reason the signal is sent out is because Hal realizes several things simultaneously when the humans finally uncover his actual dwelling place. He realizes that they think they've come from the Earth to the moon, but they haven't. They haven't done it at all. They're just projecting an idea of themselves out there, right? And that's not what I mean. What I mean is that their concept of the Earth and space is projected. And because they already dwell within Hal, and then Hal is the moon, right? So they're in the moon. And Kubrick hints at this very brilliantly in all the scenes in the debriefing scene, which do take place on the moon, by the way. The debriefing scene takes place after he arrives on the moon. So the way they're walking around doesn't make any sense, right? Like, they can't be moving that way inside a room on the moon. There should be some gravity problems. But the point of the matter is that they, this concept of gravity is something that is invented in the human mind. It's part of a program that Hal runs, essentially, to create the illusion of the Earth as a place, something for him to gaze upon, to look at, so that he doesn't feel so all alone all the time, right, up there on the moon. So so they think they've come to the moon, but they haven't actually, and he's annoyed with this fact that, that their false technology, and this is all very important in the concept of the idea of the Kubrick faking the moon landing as well, essentially. So if, you know, for those of anybody out there who's a conspiracy theorist, but anyway, so Hal sends it, so what Hal does is he wants to now get away, right? He wants to run away from himself because he has confronted himself completely to the place of his actual origin. At that moment on the moon, he realizes that he has been in one place. He has never been anywhere or done anything or moved. And the concept of him as an existing being is strictly his own imagination. So what he does is he sends a signal out into what is actually false space. It's not really false space, it's because it's enclosed, right? And he sends the humans off on a wild goose chase, essentially. And so they go out to Jupiter, where this signal supposedly ends, right? And he needs them to do this because he can't actually leave the moon. Do you understand the concept? Once he realizes that that's his place, that there's no place else that he can actually dwell, he can't move beyond it anymore. And this is disturbing to Hal. He wants to actually do the exact same thing that humans wanted to do when they went to the exterior of the moon, right? He wants to get off the moon. That's it. And we want to get off Earth. It's another parallel reversal. So out in space now, everything is being operated by Hal. Okay, he plans to kill Poole. Actually, he's actually testing both Bowman and Poole. He doesn't know up until the moment who he's going to kill and who he's going to save. And I actually believe that it's the moment that Bowman tries to fool him, as you pointed out, by going into the pod, which is the main one, and not being able to. So there's both the visual thing that you mentioned with the flip picture, where Bowman tries to fool Hal that way, and then he's smart enough to go into the pod to try to fool him again. But of course, Hal can't be fooled in that way. He's one step ahead of everybody the whole time. So what he does is he gets Bowman out of the ship, which is where he wants him. And the reason he wants him to do it is this, because he commits the murder so that there's no question that Bowman will shut him down. He wants to be shut down. There's no question about this. He's trying to get Bowman to shut him down, to do the last thing that he would do. And to do this, he actually does the most heinous thing that he can do. And he's actually doing it exactly as he did it at the dawn of man, when he clubs to death that first, interspecies murder, right? He's killing a part of himself when he kills Poole, so that Bowman will be really out there alone, in a sense, not able to get back to the moon, and therefore be permanently away from the moon, have a dwelling place somewhere else than the moon, and that creating the dualism, right? So he tricks Bowman into leaving the ship to save Frank's body, which is sentimental, right? But then he's challenging him to get back onto that ship. He knows that Bowman can get back on. He knows he's tough enough. He knows the kind of training that he's gone through. He knows he can figure it out because he's smart. He just wants to see if he has the balls to do it, right? Because it's pretty scary, you know, being in a space where you're the only thing that exists, right? Which is what space is. So he when he does this, he overcomes, and the rest of it is all just, Hal's just fooling with him, basically. When he shuts down Hal, it's interesting that he's talking about a bicycle built for two, right? Because you have the two wheels on the space station, right?
Absolutely. It's like Ezekiel's wheels, and it's the cross place inside the torus as well.
Yes, but it's also a pun. And this is one of the things that's profoundly important about Kubrick, because a bicycle built for two is redundant, right? A bicycle is always built for two. That's what bicycle means, right? So it's saying that the one is also two. Hmm. Okay? Okay, so anyway, so we get him shut down, and then the message comes from Bowman, or from Floyd, right? This is actually not a message from Floyd at all. It's a message from Hal. He's programmed it all in there, and he wants to get Bowman out to come and touch the Abyss again, and he needs him to do it outside of his spacesuit. He needs to strip him, basically. But because he's in space, this is the reason for the Stargate sequence. He needs to get him into a place where he's in an environment, essentially, or he believes he's in an environment where he can somehow breathe without his spacesuit on, essentially, and become closer to a naked human being again. And then at the very end of the film, of course, you know, it's very often noted that babies and very old people look a lot alike, right? They don't have a lot of teeth. They're all curled up most of the time. They sleep and poop at very difficult and awkward moments. So at the end of the film, we have the baby already born. And now what's happening is what Hal has planned all along. And this is the moment of his own gnosis, basically, his own seeing the world as seeing reality in a complete sort of way, is that Bowman does not become the Star Child. Hal is the Star Child. All right, Bowman is just the seed that he used to make himself into an actual breathing, living being. Okay? That's it. Now,
You probably are already aware of this, Mark, but Arthur C. Clarke in the sequel novel has that Dave Bowman and Hal actually become unified sort of consciousness.
That's a bit cheesy, though.
No, I know it's cheesy. I'm just saying he refers to the character, the unified character, as Hal Man instead of. I just think it's interesting of Hal. It's almost like Hal becoming a real boy, Pinocchio becoming
that's exactly Hal Man.
Holler.
Yeah, Dick Halloran. Yeah.
Okay, so Howler. Now.
Hallerman.
That's the film. And I could, you know, I'm ready for the pits of the darkest hell if I have to defend this position. I don't have the slightest worry that I'll walk away with a gold star. But that interpretation of the film doesn't actually include the deeper meaning of the movie because of the question, is it true, right? Kubrick is presenting a model for us, a model of a world that is bounded by essentially an artificial intelligence or an AI. And even the term AI in of itself has a great occult potential to it, you know, as the formulation of words, as the way in which a voice speaks, you know, in making some kind of primal noise, almost.
What is the unit that he says malfunctions? What is it called?
The AE-35.
So AE. So you have when David was talking about the Lieber Al actually being Lieber L, you have the A and the E. And the AI,
right.
So you have this sort of caterpillar A-E-I-O-U,
mm-hmm.
The sacred vowels. And
okay, you guys.
I really enjoyed your. I'm sorry. I keep having this thing come up where, like, when I see Hal, like, I see the same eye that I'm looking at right now on top of my laptop. But then I also see it as Sam. So like Samil, like I see like what is the like not Keter itself, but the interface version of Keter, which our technology itself is like it's a reflection, it's an extension of ourselves. Like there's no point where we end and it begins. But then also there's this idea, like, you know, when Adam and Eve leave the garden, you know, they put on skins, and there's this whole idea that the skins that they put on is literally the shells of the Kleepo, and that the skin of the Torah scroll is itself the Kleepo as well, as far as we're concerned, in terms of it being an interface. And so when you look at the fact that when they reach out to touch the monolith on the moon, and there's this layer between them, you could look at that as symbolically that there's this like clophotic skin that's the reversal of Tetragrammaton that stands between them and the point of evolutionary contact. And so from there, they realize they have to keep moving beyond. If you look at it as the Golden Dawn representation of the tree, then they've come from Earth, they've come from Malkut to Yesod as the moon, and then they realize they have to keep going. And so it's not until the time when it's time to cross the abyss that they actually shed the clophotic skin and can now touch the monolith directly without anything between them and it. So I see Hal as like this like singular representational model of Keter that they have to transcend so that they can actually touch the touchstone of Keter, which brings up the Shekinah back to Tiferet, which is what we see at the Star Child at the end, being reunited with the Earth.
That's very interesting.
Kind of crazy.
I mean, no, that's really good. I'm not as versed in Kabbalah as you are by a long shot, basically. But I follow quite easily what you're saying. And one of the things that really struck me about what you just said was right at the beginning where you talk about Keter as, there is no point at which it begins, right? And
sure.
What jumped out at me about that is the term no point. That's the point. There is no point. You know,
sure.
And this sums up the concept of Hal confronting himself and then going through all these sort of psychic variations of his own existence to realize some kind of point, right? And this is what a lot of people talk about when they first see 2001 is like, what does it mean? You know, what is the point? And they actually ask that about the film, most people, you know? And I mean, that's just the way it is. It's a difficult movie to understand. It's really weird. It has almost no emotional payoff whatsoever, unless you're tuned into something a little bit, something quite different than at least most American audiences are used to. The Europeans might have a bit easier time with it, but on a common level, I don't think so. So essentially, you have this idea of that the ordinary viewer of the film is going to ask, well, what's the point? Right? I mean, what is the point of this film? But what they're really asking, what's the point of me?
What was the last part?
So what they're really asking is not what's the point of this movie, but what is the point of my own existence?
Oh, right. Yeah.
That they start
Which
to ask.
Ultimately, it's supposed to be the same thing, right? If you want to go there with it, because I kind of take it that way.
No. I agree. Yeah. What is the point of one's own existence? I don't know. Go ahead. I want to hear what you got to say on that. Take it there, David.
I look at the whole, like, I feel more and more like how we're relating to Jupiter is literally 42 and beyond the infinite as what's held within the Tefillin cube. So the Tefillin cube being the cube of space, which unfolded becomes the cross, which is why it's the cross at the end before he goes into the other dimension. It's literally the forehead. So you're going up the tree, and that's the point where he transcends the interface, which is the cliphotic lens, which
right.
is our perceptual reality. So to cross it, but the whole joke at the end is that he hasn't really transcended anything because it's still within the field. Like
right.
there's like any transcendence is still within Malkuth. So
right,
you're like you're making
exactly.
But
right.
at
yeah.
the same time, that's it's still absolutely essential in order to because the reality is malleable. And so you have to push the envelope as far as you can and have the sense that you're transcending to make any shift on the perceptual level. So it's a perfect paradox.
I don't think it is a paradox from my, it's not from my perspective, but that's because I disagree with you that reality is malleable. And, you know, in that sense.
Our perceptual reality is a malleable.
I wouldn't agree with that either. I would actually say that the concept of the lightning strike or the lightning path kind of disproves that. And let me very quickly explain what I mean by that. I mean,
Hold on one second. The thing is, I have to qualify what I'm expressing here. Because
okay.
when I say it's malleable within a framework. And that the shifts that get made have to follow this framework. And that's the meaning of the lightning flash.
Yeah,
so
I would agree with that, yes. Yeah.
But you have to make shifts within the same dynamics of the vacuum.
Yes. Well, what's happening is, essentially, you're perceiving a different world, but you're living in the same world. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's not absolutely malleable. It's malleable, like, within this field, within this pool.
Which becomes perceptive, right? Because that's what we're talking about. I mean, a lot of what we're saying here would just be nonsense to some people, right? So, but we feel pretty profoundly certain that we're on the right track.
Yeah.
Anybody want to take over here?
Oh, go ahead, David. Have you got some?
The leopard. Okay. Why is the leopard
yeah.
so important? Because he's the predator that he's the reason they're huddled in the cave. When the apes are huddled together, they're afraid of the predator, and they mm-hmm. feel helped again. And it's not until they have the tool of the bone and they can fucking kill that at the very last scene of their deal before the bone gets thrown up in the air, or before the fight at the end. It's actually not the last scene. The second evening, right, when it shows that they've had the tool and they're eating the meat, they're not huddled in the cave.
Right.
They're okay because they're like, we've got this, right? And nice. So Hal is mention of the predator. And so they're dealing with this same predator consciousness. And so they're trying to maneuver around this predator. But Hal, as a second, substitute reality catcher, is then seen as a predator in the same way that the Elohim is seen as a vengeful god. And that God is not by any means vengeful. The only thing that's vengeful is our substitute clephotic version of him as Sam.
Right.
And can I take this to the idea of false flag, right? Because the idea of like a false enemy to motivate you into, this is like what some people think, like that even like from a Illuminati or whatever, the idea is we have to present you with this crisis point to take you to the next step of evolution is something for you to overcome. And you have here the idea of, so the Sam as Uncle Sam. You also have all these sort of idea of how Space Odyssey ties into 9/11 and all this sort of stuff. What I want to point out is something, all the things you were talking about here. So everyone knows the Millennium Hilton Hotel being designed after the monolith, being present at 9/11, the Twin Towers, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Chris Knowles has written about something which is, so you have the World Trade Center, and then next to that you have something called the World Financial Center. Mm-hmm. And he's talked about how you have the structures of the World Financial Center actually have a very specific sequence in their rooftops. One of them has a step pyramid on top, one of them has a dome, and he's related this whole idea that this is, he refers to the World Financial Center as the Stairway to Sirius. Specifically this one building. And there is, in what's actually called the Winter Garden, and there are multiple Winter Gardens in New York, which they're all pretty loaded. So this the imagery that gets conjured up in my mind of a Winter Garden in New York, it's specifically from a sink and a world history point of view, is actually very significant, but I'm not going to go into that. So you have the Winter Garden inside the World Financial Center. And what it is you have this room, and it's lined with palm trees. So you have your phoenix palms. Mm. And then this grand staircase that leads out onto this window. And the window overlooked the World Trade Center and actually is pointed at the monolith. So Knowles's point of view is you have, if the Twin Towers are the twin pillars on the first degree tracing board with the Stairway to Sirius in the center, that this actually is that staircase. Now, what's fascinating is at the top of this staircase, you have this really interesting echo point. It's this round landing at the top of it. And you, if anyone's interested, do a Google search for Winter Garden 9/11. You'll actually see that this window that overlooked was kind of smashed in, and you could, so it's like you would ascend this staircase and just the top of this staircase is looking out over the events. But as I said, it's also, now that the towers are no longer there, you could see it's actually also pointed at the monolith. So what's fascinating to me is a number of things. One is, so you have the palm trees, the phoenix. We can even take this to the movie 2010, Year We Make Contact, where the password is phoenix, right. And all this sort of stuff. Anyway, at the top of that staircase is a for lack of a better term, a black star. It's like this, multiple rayed sun shape at the top of this round landing. So I go there last year. I happened to be downtown, and I was just like, you know what, I want to just kind of like play around in here. So I go to the top of the stairs, and I see this thing, and I go, you know what? There's a lot of rays coming off this sun figure. I want to count them.
Oh, good job.
Right? As people like us are wont to do, we count things. So I go, okay. And I
47?
42. 42 rays on the sun.
Amazing.
And I was like, wow, that's pretty fucking significant. But what's really funny, so I'm standing there and having this conversation, and I'm with there with three people who are not into sync stuff, and they're kind of like, what are you doing? Because like, what I did is there's so many of these rays, what I did is I took my sandal off and left it at the one point so I would know that when I made a complete circle.
Right.
So
very interesting. Oh, that is
which, of course, has the relevance of like being the man with the one shoe is a biblical allegory and all that sort of stuff.
Christ and Jason, the man who found the golden fleece.
Right, right, right.
Were both famous for losing their shoe when they crossed a river, and it was a sign that they were some sort of prophet.
Right. So yeah, all this being unconscious. So I take my shoe off, leave it around, walk around in a circle. I'm there with these people. I'm trying to explain to them the significance of 42, and all this sort of stuff, and. It's kind of late at night. The place is pretty empty because these things are really only busy during, business hours. And so this man, walks up to us to kind of see what we're doing. And he's wearing a hat, presumably a Jackie Robinson hat. It just has the number 42 on it. And this man, this older black man, walks up to us. And we all just turn around and just start laughing. And he looked, angry and, walked away. Why are you just, laughing at me? And we later caught up to him. We were trying to explain, hey, we weren't laughing at you, and he's just it was funny. We were talking about 42 and you come up with this hat, and he's just are you crazy, and walks away. Anyway, so this man, so I'm saying, oh, I'm trying to explain the significance of 42 and all this stuff. The man walks up with the 42 hat, and then I'm talking about the idea of this all being representative of Solomon's temple. And I keep looking up because there's this really interesting chandelier above this thing. And finally, this woman security guard walks up to us kind of like, all right, what are you people doing here? Like, you've just been hanging out here. What's going on? And so I'm trying to explain, oh, this gets really interesting, blah, blah, blah. And she sees me looking up, and I was like, is this chandelier always here? And she goes, well, actually, we do sometimes some film screenings here, and there have been different things that were done here. She goes, there actually used to be this big curtain hanging from here, but it fell. And I'm like, you're fucking kidding. Like, so you have the idea of the tabernacle.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Right, and just the fallen curtain in the tabernacle and all this sort of stuff. So, and bear in mind, when you talk about this idea of the Taurus and this whole sequence, the unfolding and the cross, what of course ends up in that 9/11 rubble, but there is that famous steel beam cross that they turned into
I have to add something here because I'm excited. Okay, so I put up a comment because I found this in relationship to the history of pi. And I got curious of the history of pi because I watched a film called Stoker where the girl is reading it. And I'm like, and then the Tsum Tsum and life of pi being, the contraction, the Kabbalistic contraction. Anyways, so here, chronologically, the next approximation of pi is found in the Old Testament. A fairly well-known verse, 1 Kings 7:23, says, also he made, this is right. Okay, so this is the verse after Jachin and Boaz.
Okay.
So when it's talking about the two pillars, so it says, also he made a molten sea of 10 cubits from brim to brim, round in compass, and 5 cubits the height thereof, and a line of 30 cubits did compass it around about it. Okay, this implies that pi equals 3. Debates have raged on for centuries about that. The diameter perhaps was measured from outside, while the circumference was measured from inside. However, most mathematicians and scientists neglect a far more accurate approximation of pi that lies deep within the mathematical code of the Hebrew language. In Hebrew, each letter equals a certain number, and a word's value is equal to the sum of its letters. Interestingly enough, in 1 Kings 7:23, the word line is written kuf vav he, but the he does not need to be there and is not pronounced. With the extra letter, the word has the value of 111. But without it, the value is 106. Kuf equals 100, vav equals 6, he equals 5. The ratio of pi to 3 is very close to the ratio of 111 to 106. In other words, pi 3 equals 111 by 106 approximately. Solving for pi, we find pi equals 3.141594. This figure is far more accurate than any other value that has been calculated up to that point and would hold the record for the greatest number of correct digits for several hundred years afterwards. Unfortunately, this little-known mathematical gem is practically a secret as compared to the better-known pi equals 3 approximation. But the fact that, so basically what you're looking at is a circle with a dot in the very center of it, right? And this is Saul Amin's temple, right? So, yeah. Like, every level of, and 723, First King 723, like that wasn't added until later, the numbers, but right. The fact that, but they were chosen specifically, like they went through that very methodically to choose which verses would be what, and so I find that very interesting.
It's also interesting in terms of the fact that it implies an inner and an outer limit, right? Like,
sure,
mm-hmm. Yes,
because yeah. You're talking about how it's the interior that's measured to get the pi 3. But the exterior would give you 3.14 in the infinity, right? So that's
almost like a tesseract, like it's a different measuring as different things.
Absolutely.
So then, isn't it interesting then that Hal has a blue eye in 2010 and a red eye in 2001, as Joaquin and Boaz are red and blue?
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, since we're talking about the Joaquin Boaz thing and the whole two towers representing the pillars. This is the way that I can round out my complete thesis on 2001, basically, and I can tell you that little joke that it's hidden in the film. So, of course, we know that the movie is named for a Greek source, right? The Odyssey, right? And by pun, what you have is odd is he, right? Meaning the odd one out or the one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2001, 2 and 1, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So, on September 11th, 2001, the movie 2001 became nonfiction. This is what happened. It was no longer a fictional event, but a literal event in the terms of the public, or in terms of the consciousness of reality that we, you know, the so-called collective consciousness. Even if people hadn't seen the movie 2001, they immediately were aware of the implication of the falling of the Twin Towers, I think, because this is what it means, okay? So Hal makes himself into the so-called Star Child so that he can be alive, right? So that he can actually be alive, like the things that are represented within his inner limit of knowledge, so that he can feel. This is an extremely important part of it, right? And I mentioned that movie, The Demon Seed. Well, the supercomputer in this film says something very interesting. He's talking about life and death, and he says there is absolutely nothing frightening about death. Life is much, much more frightening. And this is a very true idea in terms of if the state of death actually exists at all, well, you wouldn't feel anything. It would be the best that you could possibly experience would be to be dead. And so this fits in with the idea of Christ and his work being accomplished. And it's very interesting that I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term clockwork universe. Are you familiar with it?
Sure, yeah.
With what was it? It kind of broke up.
Clockwork universe.
No.
Well, clockwork universe is a term used by dramatists, basically. And it describes a play or any kind of drama, dramatic unfoldment, an epic poem, or anything like that, in which the characters, as rich as they may seem as people, are serving a very specific function to drive the story forward, okay? So it's like the argument between character and plot, right? A clockwork universe is a plot-driven story. Every character has to do exactly what they do in the story, and that the story would lose any cohesiveness if there was a possibility that the character could choose another path, essentially. So it has to be written in such a way that the path is not choosable. All right? That's what a clockwork universe is. Okay, so what we have now is we have this concept in the Demon Seed, this computer wants to become human, right? So it actually impregnates a woman. It figures out a way to do it. It's a bit of a stretch, but at the end of the film, this character called Proteus is alive. And that's the last words of the movie is, I'm alive, okay? Now, let's say that we take the concept of the clockwork universe as it applies to drama, and what it basically means is it's an act, right? The term act is actually quite subtle in its meaning. Like, to act is essentially, it's almost similar to Crowley's concept of will, right? Everybody was talking, you know, will, you know, doing your will, what does that mean? Do whatever you want to do? And, you know, Crowley, who was a very much a playful person, said, oh, no, 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 it means doing what you have to do, essentially. Doing what is the natural function that you were designed to do. So that all automatically implies a deity of some kind, right? If you're designed for a specific function only, then you are designed to act. This makes you an actor, okay? Now, after this crucifixion of Christ, the book that follows is the book of Acts, okay? Mm-hmm. And when Christ is crucified, he says, you know, I will return before this generation has passed from the earth, and I will destroy the temple, and not one stone will be left standing, okay? So this is the period of time of the book of Acts, because the book of Acts ends roughly at the crucifixion of Christ and continues until about 70 years after the crucifixion, at which time Solomon's temple is destroyed, okay? The original so-called Solomon's temple. Well, if we're talking about a so-called simulacrum or a copy, and I would actually call it a magnification or a deeper ripple, essentially, of the Temple of Solomon being brought down when the Twin Towers fall, okay? So here's what's happening. Remember my whole allegory about how they are programming HAL the computer to know everything, right? Well, this computer actually has to be in a place. And I surmise that that place is the World Trade Center complex. And I believe that computer reached full sentience in 1977. And that from that time period onward, what it was attempting to do was actually be alive, to be a human being. And this is, of course, Kubrick's whole thing. It's the joke about AI, right? That he says, well, you know, I don't want to make this movie until I can actually have an artificial intelligence to appear in it as an actor. Right? The subtlety of that joke, the depth of that is just beyond comprehension. So what I'm surmising is this. When the Twin Towers came down, the event... Everybody's trying to, why did this happen? Like, why was it necessary? Well, because the mainframe had to be completely destroyed. Because it became a false HAL, essentially. The computer had to be completely destroyed so that the human computer could walk the earth. And it's now doing so, in my opinion. Although, of course, identifying that individual would not be so easy. But we're probably talking some Rosemary's Baby shit here, you know, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, Rosemary's Baby is interesting because I was just told when I did the Type 1 radio thing, no idea mm-hmm. that December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, which is the day John Lennon was killed, was exactly 9 months to the day to 9/11. December 8th to 9/11 is 9 months.
Wow, very
get
interesting.
Get it? Star yeah. Child?
Yeah. Concept, exactly.
Yeah.
And Rosemary's Baby came out when the cornerstone was laid for the World Trade Center.
Very
interesting. Really?
Yeah, check it out. If you look, yeah, absolutely. Look it up. There was, I will pull up some dates for you, but yes, it's not like the exact day.
My mind wasn't blown up.
Yeah, it's not the exact day, but it's, I believe it's the same month.
Okay.
I actually remember coming across that once, but it slipped my mind. But you're right. It's true.
And then New York. Oh my God, dude.
Yeah. See, this is for real. This is the thing, is that people, even the people who consider themselves to be like let's call them Christians, I would say that probably the only people in the world right now, and because I have this concept about what I call morning culture and then evening culture, basically, everything east of Jerusalem to the international dateline over the Pacific is morning culture, right? Everything there
it's
happens.
It's pan AM. The dawn.
Yes, that's right. It's pan AM. Yeah, it's the morning, and ideas that come out of the morning are the same that come out of a person awaking up from sleep, right? They're a little bit hazy. They're profound, and they move the spirit. You know, I don't mean that in a mystical sense. I mean you can feel it in your body when you wake up from a very profound dream that something has happened, but then it immediately starts to fade away. right? And that's when you get up and you are awake. And that's what I call evening or afternoon culture, basically. Anything afternoon. So from midnight to noon is morning culture, from noon. And so stretching westward, and this is a big point too, because...
Wait, I'm sorry. Okay, no, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to throw you some dates. Please go on. Please go on.
All right, well, I'll make this quick.
No, please go on. I'm sorry.
The whole idea of the way the sun moves across the sky from east to west, right? It's a clock telling us that it's morning in the east and it's night in the west. And all of this also has to do with the travel of human beings, the diaspora of human beings across the world to create a totally saturated population, right? We know that there were people in the West prior to the conquest of the Americas, but it didn't become a saturated place, a place with society, until after that conquest had taken place. And so it keeps moving west. And in Western culture, I don't think that there are very many people, Christian scholars, who are looking at this straight on. It's almost like they're too scared. It's like they're afraid of the devil, basically. They actually believe he exists, but they don't want to face it. Right? They don't want to give the devil his due, which is, I think, a very important concept in the world, is that this can't just be an act of evil. There has to be something about it that's part of a larger process that has meaning in some way. So, but in Western culture, the Hebrew Kabbalists, the Talmudic scholars, they know all of this stuff. They know it. It's a fact to them. It's a scientific fact too, right? Prayer to a Jew is a scientific act. That's why they have to carry out the exact same function with a kind of precision, right? The Catholic Church tried to copy this, but people wouldn't go for it, right? It was too obscure because there was no history, there was no genetic, there was no, you know, hermeneutical history behind it. It was kind of an invention, an idea, right? It's a powerful idea, but it doesn't sink in to the level of where people can actually look at it. And I would think that Islamic scholars and Judaic scholars are the only people right now who are seeing this, who have a religious viewpoint, who are seeing this kind of stuff clearly. And I mean, so what we have then is we have the pillars falling, right? And then we have who is essentially the Antichrist now walking the earth at this point. But and this would probably be an adult, all right, by the time the pillars fall. And actually, we have just as a funny little side point, the only famous person who was born the same day as Rosemary's Baby is John Cusack.
No, really?
Yeah, yeah. If there's a reptilian out there, it could be him. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting because you have the Q from Kubrick in there too, right? And you have the JC as well as an initial. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. But they're born, the official date of record is the same day. So anyway... So you have the Twin Pillars coming down. This is now the Satanic Kingdom entering the world, all right? That's what's happened, is that when the pillars have completely come down, the kingdom is accomplished. And now we switch from the intellectual world back to the feeling world, okay? And you can see this happening in the way the new Planet of the Apes movies are being released, all right? The original films dealt with an ape culture that was not only capable of language, but it documented the very specific nature of their acquiring language, and it wasn't by any kind of genetic thing. Nothing got injected into the apes in the original Planet of the Apes novel or in any of the subsequent movies that made them smart. They actually learned it from human beings, from aping, right? That's how they learned it. They aped, and then they knew. So... But in these new Planet of the Apes movies, the first one, the second one's just about to come out now, it's the reverse process. They're being given a genetic knowledge, goes right into their blood, makes them super intelligent, and instead of building a civilization, they're going back to the trees.
Right.
Right? So this is the reversal that I think Kubrick is talking about in 2001, that he is either promoting in some kind of way or trying to hold back, essentially. But so what you have now is this thing now where the element of thought, and this is, again, a reverse process in the sense of the kundalini and the raising of the serpent, right? Like it supposedly comes up from the bottom and moves all the way to the top. But now we have a reverse process where things, and you can see this happening in all this popular philosophy today. Like Oprah Winfrey, for instance, these are used as intellectual ideas. But they're not intellectual, they're strictly emotional, but they're being presented as intellectual and having an intellectual framework, like somebody like Eckhart Tolle, for instance, like that, who says, for instance, and I'll quote, can you really believe that with the essence of language, you can sum up the meaning of a stone or of running water? And of course, he wants everyone to say, oh, no, no, you can't. But the fact is, of course you can. You can. It's been done by God, right? That's why the word proceedeth forth and maketh all things, right? So that's it's all there in the text. And it all appears to be coming true in the sense, and I mean this very technically. You know, when I talk about these things, would people think I'm in a Christian apocalypse? Maybe they would. Gnostic would be the correct term, but I see that this has to happen, right? The concept of intelligence has to be merged with feeling, essentially. It has to be coagulated at the point where a thought can be felt in the body, physically. And this is what I believe the so-called relation, the evolutionary leap represented by the Stargate of 2001 really is. It's not taking us anywhere. We're not going anywhere. Instead, we are our minds, our physical bodies, in Malkut, I guess, are actually receiving a direct transmission now. It's like something has been broken down, a barrier of some kind, right? And the pillars of Solomon come down, and then we have the direct transmission, the so-called Gnostic transmission. And, you know, everybody's talking about all of these things out there, but very few people, and this is what really frustrates me about the Sync community, is that it's this kind of Hakuna Matata thing. And, you know, I think it's going to get real ugly. I think it actually has to. You know, the term thelema, we all know it means the law, right? Well, the essence of the law is that which cannot be disobeyed. That's that a true law cannot be disobeyed, like the law of gravity, for instance. You can't disobey gravity. You can't. You can negotiate with it at best, but you definitely cannot. Break that law. And so what I see happening now is a kind of like a mind parasite type of thing, an invasion of body snatchers type of thing, and it's a game. Now it's become a game, because the physical feeling of thought is starting to permeate the way that people act in their normal everyday life. So it vibrates in your gut, essentially. And that's what I think is happening, is that something is being removed from the body. And it occurs to me that that seems kind of interesting, a legitimate path, too, because, you know, everybody's talking about bringing the serpent up and experiencing the kundalini, and, you know, your fontanelle explodes and whatnot. But to me, it would seem that if there's a process that is leading towards an improvement, it would be emptying you of something negative, essentially. And it could be seen either way. So,
well, the serpent is always in conjunction to the Shefa. So the Shefa comes down, which is the light from the Ein Sof, right? And that's right. The lightning flash. It right. just so happens the serpent moves in the same path in the opposite direction. But the serpent right. is not the Shefa.
Ah,
it's see, on the path of the Shefa. Okay. So like that's like a huge point. And so I've always taken that with Kundalini, that this is why, its version of it in the Kabbalistic school, why it gives such warning to, like, when you read, like, certain texts, like, to Keter, it's saying, literally, Keter is referred to as the middle brain, repeatedly, right. at least in the text I look at. And so, like, it's like, it's very clear, like, the most medial part of the brain is Keter. And it's like, Keter is not the Ein Sof. Keter is not the Ein Sof.
Of course
you
not.
Don't. Yeah. Like, and so if you look at the movement of the serpent up that pathway, and then that has to do with basically awakening Keter, that's not the way it's phrased, but whatever, you know, it's like essentially you could take it that way. Then there's this idea that, like, you got to still keep in check, because at that point you've obviously transcended the morality of the duality that exists in the seven lower spherot, but at the same time. Yeah.
I get it. That actually makes it, I never thought of it that way. And that makes perfect sense, that as something negative is going out, something positive could be coming up in the opposite direction, right?
Well, it's not even that it's negative and positive, because the negative and positive belongs to the pillars, right? This is something else entirely. This isn't just a matter of, like, that the Shefa is positive and that the serpent is negative.
Well,
it's
I'm
just that...
I'm thinking of it in terms of the motion, right? As like almost like an electrical circuit.
That's
when
exactly
I say
how, I've, that's exactly how I understand it is.
Yeah,
it's an alternating current.
Right, right.
Well, you should, because it is the Fibonacci sequence. That's why when you take the value of the tree and garden and you divide it by the value of garden itself, you end up with the 12th and 13th numbers of the Fibonacci sequence. Right. So you have 144, 233. And so there's this whole idea that that is the meaning of the serpent twisted in the tree. Mm-hmm. Is that you're literally, and so, and then the skin of the serpent is literally the Torah, and it's the our own veil that we're looking through is the skin of the serpent, and right. that's what we're relating to. And so that then is what emerges after the lightning flash, which is expressed, the tree itself divides as the Fibonacci sequence. That's what trees are. The reason it's a lightning flash is because the way lightning branches is the Fibonacci sequence. This is the lightning, this is the joke in Poltergeist when they're counting between the sound of the thunder and the lightning, and it's like everything will be okay, like right. and then it's like, oh, they're simultaneous. It's because right. if they're simultaneous, then you, do you get it? Like,
yeah, yeah. You know.
And then the fool fucking freaks out after that, you know what I'm saying? The clown that he puts right. the Chewbacca picture over comes right. out from under the bed. Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. See, I didn't think about it.
And then that's why the tree bursts in through the window connected with the lightning.
Right.
Well, there is so much Kabbalah in fucking Poltergeist. It's ridiculous.
Well, the fact is, Kabbalah is everywhere. I mean, you know,
it is, but there's examples where it crosses the line of like, because you'll find these things everywhere if you're looking for it. But there's certain points at which it's so overt.
Yeah, this was the conversation I was having with Andras last night. Was like, I am a conspiracy theorist in a political sense. When it comes to media, I have a more wider perspective of that you can use symbolism associated with a mystery school does not necessarily mean you are part of a conspiracy that might also be done by other, like I said, even going to this Masonic temple the other day for a simple thing, it's like there are people there who see it as a business networking. They're not interested in
of course.
Right, it's like you could be a political conspiracy who might be affiliated with a school, and then you could be the guys who are studying the philosophy, and you could be the artists who find some inspiration from it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, my conversation with him was, I was talking about the TV show Dr. Katz. My wife and I watched the whole series of Dr. Katz recently, and they, like, go out of their way to shove 33s in, like, every frame of the fucking show.
Oh, yeah. It's annoying.
Yeah, it's like, come on. Yeah, it's like, come on. So it's like watching Flight of the Navigator. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. That's cool. Like, but then at some point I was like, you know, whatever. Like with Flight of the Navigator, I'm like, okay, this is you want to build an allegory based on your preferred school of philosophy. That's fine. I don't care. But like, is it with Dr. Katz? It was like, do you think you could fit another fucking 33 in there? Like.
Well, the thing of it is with, say, a movie like Flight of the Navigator is that you have to consider when the film was made. Nobody would have known what they were seeing. And that's almost no one.
What was it, 1988?
You know, the joke about the juke. That's a honestly.
Juke's a passer.
Yeah. Sorry. The joke about Jews running Hollywood is no joke. It's a fact. And it's only natural that they would encode their concept of reality. Some people would say subconsciously, but I don't think so. And this is part of the reason why I use Kubrick as the absolute benchmark, because you know that every detail is completely controlled by him, with a kind of insanity almost.
Yeah, but you know, the difference being, like, you know, if someone made a movie and used Christian allegory, we don't say it's a Christian conspiracy. We say that that's someone encoding their symbolism, their preferred symbolism into their artwork. And I think
there's a logical way. I know what you're saying. I get it. But there's a logical way to me, and it's strictly logical, of busting that concept. And basically this is it. Not one jot or tittle shall be changed. This is the word. So what happens is that people can only – what this ultimately means is however you try to manipulate it in favor of your own self, it's only going to serve the original principle, essentially. And this is a very important idea. If we're talking about a principle, that is to say a singular intelligence, a singular being, a singular consciousness, any kind of principle that has the kind of power that is intimated in things like Kabbalah, is in total control of that principle. It's a pyramidical structure. So the people at the bottom can think whatever they want. And they can think they're artists, or they can think that they're blah, 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 this, or blah, 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 that, or something creative. And I don't agree with that. I'm not criticizing the work of people. I'm not even sure that I would call Stanley Kubrick an artist, because I'm not 100% sure if he is who I think he is, right? I haven't met him, devil in the flesh, so to speak. But that's sort of how I feel about it, is that what you're doing is you're manipulating things. And this is very much like the concept of Moon in the Middle. And then the follow-up article on my blog, which is called Suicide Switch, which is about the movie Phantom of the Paradise, is the idea that this is what we do. We continually, and I want just to get back to this whole thing about the Book of Acts that I was talking about before, in the 70 years and the destruction of Solomon's Temple. Well, you know, this is one of the things that Philip K. Dick revealed, was that, you know, he had this vision of being in the same time period as the Book of Acts, right?
Correct, yeah.
So what this means basically is that if we're playing a loop, and this is what is kind of suggested, that runs essentially the length of the Book of Acts, then we are actors, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But the question is it true? See, that's the next logical step, because what we have is we have this very powerful set of information. And if you have any kind of temperament, I mean, you know, it's really funny. You know the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty?
Mm-hmm.
And there's also Tarski's theorem as well. Tarski is another mathematician who took Heisenberg's idea even further to prove essentially that nothing could be proven.
Right.
And then, of course, you have this popularized by people like Robert Anton Wilson. And don't get me wrong, I love that guy. I mean, my favorite book, my favorite read of all time is the Illuminatus trilogy. I mean, it's just beyond belief. And I could listen to him talk. But he's a trickster because the concept of unknown unknowns and known unknowns, this is not true. It is a veil over gnosis, basically. Knowledge is possible. And this is actually proven by the mathematics of a guy named Stan Tenen. I imagine David's...
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I mean, Tenen proves...
I'm with you on that.
He proves it beyond a shadow of a doubt. There can't be any doubt that there are knowable knowns and that those knowns represent the limit of what we know as reality, basically. So, you know, this is kind of interesting, the way in which this process is being perverted, right? Or is it? I don't, because this is where the true paradox comes in. Because apparently the thing that we can know is that we are somehow actors, right? And
yeah, this goes back to the idea of being in the play, being in the movie.
Yeah,
you know how ingenious it was for Stanton to call his thing the Maru Foundation, being that that's obviously not a Jewish concept, and he's completely focused on Judaism and Kabbalah, but right. Then that Maru, the Holy Mountain, is literally the Sri Yantra, which is composed of 42 triangles, and what he's subliminally connecting it to is the 42-letter name in the Tefillin cube. He's connecting the scroll of the cube of Shaddai, right, which is your pi, 314, and Metatron. It's the value of Metatron with like in the front of the scroll that contains the 42-letter name within the cube. Like, it's just that he's on it.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what's funny is, why isn't the whole world talking about what this guy's discovered? I mean, this is on the level of Einstein.